It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. And I have this memory of being a child growing up in Anchorage, of being asleep in bed, and then the phone rings, and it's the next door neighbor calling saying, "Get outside, the aurora is out." And everybody throws their coats on and their boots on over their pajamas, and in the street, we're all standing there looking straight up in the sky, seeing this amazing, awesome display. It is sort of the quintessentially Alaskan experience. It is also an outdoor experience, and that's our topic today on the show. We're going to be talking about seeing the aurora, your aurora memories. Where does the aurora come from? What's it made of? And also how to capture it in a photograph. And we're really interested in hearing from you, hearing your stories and questions. You can get on the show by calling us in Anchorage at 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. And there's lots of activity going on Facebook at Outdoor Explorer. It's a good place to go to comment or ask questions if you don't want to be on the air. And our producer, Kristen, will be pulling those out and giving them to me to ask to our guests. So we have a guest on the phone from Fairbanks. Roger Smith is a professor emeritus at the Geophysical Institute. Thanks for being with us, Roger.
Glad to be here.
And Todd Salat is the aurora hunter, a professional photographer who spends his time roaming around Alaska looking for the aurora and getting some incredible pictures of them. Thanks for being with us, Todd.
It's a pleasure and an honor, Charles.
And you can find some of those pictures on our website, and some of them are just quite extraordinary, including a really neat graphic that Todd created where he has overlaid a graph of solar activity with the times he's taken amazing pictures. One of his terrific videos is there, catching light waves. And so we're going to talk all about that. But I want to start out talking to Roger from the Geophysical Institute. I know you've probably done this explanation a million times, but what the heck is the aurora? What produces these colors and lights and motion in the sky?
Well, the light form of the aurora is the effect of protons and electrons coming from the sun being trapped in the Earth's magnetic field and being allowed to fall into the atmosphere. And when they fall into the atmosphere, they have enough energy to excite the atoms and molecules very high up. We're now talking 60 to 300 miles altitude. At these altitudes, when they hit those atoms and molecules, the response is for them to emit light. And so what we see are actually lights which are characteristic of the atmospheric composition. So we're seeing light from oxygen and light from nitrogen and some compounds of oxygen and nitrogen, like nitric oxide, for example.
And so for those of us who remember a little bit of their high school sciences, those energized particles are hitting these atoms of oxygen or nitrogen. They're exciting them, and they're giving off they're absorbing energy and then giving off light, characteristic of whatever element it is that's in that molecule in the atmosphere.
That's correct.
All right.
Yeah.
So I understand we're coming into kind of an aurora hot period when the sun is more active, and I've also been told that the vernal and autumnal equinoxes are good times for the aurora. Is that a fact?
Well, there certainly is a slight statistical preference for the autumnal and vernal equinox. It's not dramatic, but you can see it in occurrences that are recorded in different observatories. In Fairbanks, of course, it's very good to be here and looking in March because we typically get clear skies. And for most observers, clear sky is one of the most desirable things about seeing the aurora. You've got to have a clear sky, obviously, otherwise you don't see it.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, so, although it is true that auroras are slightly more prevalent during the vernal and autumnal equinoxes, really what you want to focus on is when is a time where the sky is typically clear at your location for observing.
And what about solar activity? Is that peak coming on, and how does that peak look? Because I understand the amount of solar activity rises and falls through the years.
Yes, it does. The principal variation period is 11 years, and they call that the solar cycle, 11 years. It's not the only periodicity there. In fact, there is one at 22 years, and there's another one at about 100 years. What's happening to us today because of this is that although maxima occur every 11 years, about every 100 years, those maxima are going down to being rather small. And so if we compare the maximum that is coming up and is here about now to one that happened around 1960, say, this is less than half of the intensity of that maximum in 1960.
But Todd, let me turn to you. It sounds like you've been seeing some pretty extraordinary aurora, even if the maximum is not what it might have been 11 years or in the past.
Yeah, there's definitely been some aurora activity out there. Perhaps, you know, statistically, not quite like 11 years ago, back in the 2000-2001 peak phase, it was, you know, going crazy often. But there's still a lot out there. This past year, 2012, for me was, you know, wonderful. Got some of the best shots of my entire life. They're spotty, though. You really got to put in your time and look a lot. And, of course, stay up all night. Some of the best shows I saw were around 5 a.m. and 6 a.m. So there's still auroras out there. We're in the peak phase right now, so it's happening.
Yeah. So you call yourself the Aurora Hunter, and you've got aurorahunter.com. There's a link to that. And incidentally, there's also a link to a lot of cool stuff from the Geophysical Institute on our alaskapublic.org website. You just go to alaskapublic.org and then click on the icon for Outdoor Explorer. But when you're an aurora hunter, how do you go about hunting an aurora? It seems to me that it's always serendipity when I see one.
Luck definitely plays a major, major role in aurora hunting. But I say the more you're out there and the more you look, the luckier you get. So I have a camper on the back of my truck, and I'm a night owl by nature, so that makes it very easy for me to stay up all night. I usually go to bed about the time the sun's coming up, and then it's just about putting in your time. So from Anchorage based, where I live here with my wife, we head north usually because they're more common up towards Rogers neck of the wood up there, woods up there by Fairbanks. So we'll head north into the Alaska Range, maybe Hatcher Pass, and just spend time. You know, usually 1 to 2 weeks I'll be out there just sleeping all day and staring at the sky all night. And I just came back from an aurora hunt last week, and I saw them 2 out of 7 nights, so I was feeling pretty good about that, and had just one just grandiose experience where they were right overhead, and it was just awesome. It's what I live for.
Wow. So tell me, I mean, the aurora must mean something very special to you, because you dropped out of the corporate world, as it were, and you decided to devote your life to pursuing them. Do you remember the first time you saw it, or when you got this inspiration that this was going to be something that you focused on?
Very definitely. I have a very clear picture in my mind of that. I was attending graduate school down at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. It was back in 1989 in March. And little did I know that was going to be one of the famous aurora nights on record, kind of the once-in-a-decade experience. So there I was on top of a mountain with a bunch of geologists around a campfire with a beverage in our hand, and the whole sky was turning just blood red. And it was like, oh my gosh. So then I was transfixed. You know, I got the scientific thing going on in my mind, and here's this beautiful sky. And I also had just scored a job in Alaska with ARCO Alaska as an exploration geologist. So that was my ticket to AK back in 89. And almost immediately, once I got up here, I started photographing them. And the rest for me is history, because I became a night owl and started burning the candle at both ends till finally I just, something had to give. So I lasted 7 years in the corporate world there as a geologist. And then I say the 7-year itch got me, and I quit to do this full time as an aurora hunter. And that was going on 16 years ago now. So that's kind of my previous life, I call that.
That's amazing. Most of us would never have the daring to just drop out and follow your dream like that. And it sounds like it's worked out for you all these years.
That was wonderful. Yeah. You know, at the time I was single, no mortgage, no kids. So it was easy for me to kind of do the old resign and travel and then come to Alaska and make this my lifestyle.
Roger, I want to ask you kind of the same question. You've obviously devoted a large part of your professional life to studying the aurora. What was it that attracted you to this as a topic or something that you wanted to learn more about?
Well, when I started as a graduate student, I was back in England. You can probably hear that in my accent. And I was studying lights from the night sky, and I remember one night I was living in Exeter, which is down in the southwest of England, and this huge aurora came over the sky, and I was trying to attract people's attention to it in the middle of the city. You could see it through the city lights. It was so bright, and a policeman came up to me and thought I was drunk. You know, what was I doing, showing this and making so much noise? But that was my first experience of an aurora. And actually, in the end, long story short, I ended up uprooting and coming all the way to Alaska because I could see auroras every night from where I was located, and not have to wait for the odd one that happened to come that far south. And so, you know, just what Todd was saying there is true of the life of many people here at the Institute, that we have spent a whole night staying up watching for the aurora. Sometimes because we are going to launch a rocket to go through the aurora, other times because we're just trying to take records ourselves on the ground. You just have to wait until the aurora comes. It's no use saying it's, you know, time to go to bed at 11 o'clock.
That's right. Well, we're talking about the Northern Lights, the aurora on Outdoor Explorer today. And I've got some questions for listeners that I want to give to our guests, but I also want to let you know what the phone numbers are here. It's 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. And on Facebook, you can get your written questions in and interact with other listeners at Outdoor Explorer. And I want to, you know, our guests were talking about their aurora memories. I have this extraordinary memory of being a kid and being on a small plane flying from Fairbanks to Anchorage in the middle of winter, and I believe my family had been to a church function in Fairbanks where there was a new bishop being installed, and we're flying over Denali, and this incredible aurora display fills the sky, and it's just a sense of being, you know, you get this awesome sense of the grandeur and beauty of everything, but also of your incredibly tiny size in this universe. So I don't know. What are your memories of the aurora? I'd like to hear you share them. Here's a question for you, Todd, which is coming from a listener online, asking, how do you take a decent photo? She's asking using her new DSLR. I guess it's probably easier with digital than it was with film, but still not easy because how do you focus on it? How do you pick up something that's so dim? You know, and you've gotten these amazing pictures. What are some of the tips that you have for people?
Well, if you have your camera right in front of you, I actually brought mine in here too so I could reference it, but it's actually a fairly simple process. If you have a camera that's got the M setting, so M for manual. With these cameras, I definitely want to go fully manual so you have control over all of your settings, your exposure, your aperture, whatnot. I get asked often, you know, how do you take pictures of it? And the people who say that they've tried and don't get anything, I go, was your picture black? And 9 times out of 10, they say yes, which means it was underexposed. So the critical part here is that you have a camera that you can do a several second long exposure with. So you get it set on M, you figure out your shutter speed, usually put it around 5 or 10 seconds, meaning, you know, on a daytime picture you go ka-ching, that's an exposure, but at nighttime it goes chick-king. So it's a long time exposure, and it lets the Northern Lights burn themselves onto film back in the day, or these days on your digital sensor. The next step would be to open up your aperture on your lens so it's wide open. So that's the old f-stop number. The lower the number, like f2.8 or f3.5, the bigger the aperture. And that's critical. And then the last setting that's for the exposure would be your ISO, the sensitivity of your camera's sensor. And I usually just crank mine up to 1600 ISO, 10 second exposure at f2.8 or f3.5, depending on what kind of lens you have. And then
you're basically all the settings to let as much light in as possible.
Yeah. It's like at nighttime when your pupils of your eyeball get big and dark and black, your eye is opening up and trying to get as much light at night as possible. And it's the same thing with a camera. I think of this as a night vision goggles. You want that open aperture, sensitive sensor, and then a long exposure to let that light kind of build up. So all of my pictures I've taken are, you know, maybe the shortest I've got is a 2-second exposure, but it goes right on up to 10 or 12 seconds easily. And then one critical element here is the tripod. You have to have your camera stabilized. Now, I've put my camera on the hood of my truck, sitting on a pillow in emergency situations, but I would go out, if you don't have a tripod, I wouldn't even try it. So go out and get, even if it's a cheap tripod at a, you know, big box store, anything to stabilize your camera. And I could go on and on about, mm-hmm. you know, the details on that. But I actually brought my camera in here. So I've got it set for a 4-second exposure. One little trick is you set the self timer on 2 seconds so that you're not touching the camera when you set it off. So right now, I'll push my camera. 2 seconds, it'll go off. Okay, it's exposing right now for 4 seconds. Okay, that was a 4-second exposure. That's what your camera wants to sound like. And you know that you're going to be recording some of that nighttime, you know, grandeur on your camera. And you can go show off your hero shots, everybody.
So there must be different levels of brightness, and also there are different colors. And I guess turning to you, Roger, what determines how bright the aurora is going to be, and which elements, like, give you the different colors? I mean, it seems like green is the most common, and it's sort of your everyday sort of less exciting auroras, just sort of green streaks. But then sometimes you get these multicolored ones that are very bright. What's causing those colors, and what's causing the change in brightness?
Well, actually, the green, which is the most common color, is a form of oxygen that you hardly ever see down here at the ground level in the atmosphere. It's actually atomic oxygen. Oxygen is normally molecular at the ground level, but up at the altitude of the aurora, quite a significant part of the oxygen is atomic. And the green that you see is just one of the atomic emissions which oxygen emits. There is also a red one. Usually when you see that red, you think of it as blood red. And it is, it's usually fairly diffuse. It doesn't have many sharp streaks in it. But then that's for atomic oxygen. Then there is there's nitrogen. Many people see a purple color in the aurora, particularly during the early evening or the late morning when it's still dark, but coming up to twilight conditions, there will be a purple color. That's the ionized nitrogen. The chemical name for that is N2+. And that is the atmosphere actually resonating in sunlight. And you'll see that when you see that purple color. There is also a lower red border, often on a green emission. The green curtain of aurora will have a lower border in red. And that will be another nitrogen emission. That one is neutral nitrogen, which is occurring right at the bottom of the aurora. So those are the very common colors. There are certainly other ones, but those are the ones that typically turn out on your pictures, you'll notice. The other ones are not so bright, and you need a spectrometer to know what they are. But they reflect the composition of the atmosphere, and their brightness depends upon the intensity of electrons coming into the atmosphere.
So how strong the solar flare was, or whatever the ejection was from the sun, is going to determine if we have an aurora and how strong it is?
Well, the fact of the solar flare is important. But, of course, a lot has happened to the electron flux that comes from the sun from the time it emits to the time it actually gets into the atmosphere. It doesn't come directly. You know, you might say, well, everything is going to come straight from the sun, but it doesn't. It actually collects in the magnetic field around the Earth and primarily on the side away from the sun. We have a term for that. We call it the magnetospheric tail. But all it means is it's just like a balloon extending away from the sun that is being filled with the electron flux, which is coming because of the flare. And then the pattern that we see, which is typically on the night side of the Earth rather than the sun side, is affected by the way in which those electrons are thrown back at the Earth. And that is actually more effective in creating the brightness itself than is the brightness of the original flare.
Hmm. Amazingly complex phenomenon. I'd like to go to Caroline now, who's calling from Anchorage. Caroline?
Yes, hi. This is making me reminisce about the old days. Before I ask the question that always stirs a lot of controversy, I wanted to ask these gentlemen if especially the gentleman that works at Geophysical Institute. When I was a student, I did some techie-type work up there, nothing really scientific, but Dr. Shinaka Sofu had come to work on his doctorate in the aurora, and his work and some of the film strips that we got in from Russia and one other Scandinavian country. Anyway, it was the old Oster K machine, and what we were supposed to do was to trace the outline of the aurora, which was then digitized, and that's how they traced aurora from other places. But the main thing that I remember is Hilde and Gus Lamprecht were the janitors, and they worked from 4 to midnight, and they were from Germany. In fact, Gus had been an aide to Rommel in the North African campaign. We got some great people up there. But anyway, Gus made some of the original, really iconic pictures of the aurora. They lived in Golden Valley, and the light didn't bleed in from Fairbanks to the point of destroying the opportunity to make great photos. And the one that I purchased was a cabin and cache with the blue and red, with maybe a touch of green, aurora. And I just was wondering, they can comment on whether or not they've seen those of Gus's work. But the question that stirs controversy is, does the aurora really hiss? I swear that I've heard it, but I may be in the minority or the majority, and I just thought that might stir some interest.
Yeah, that's a good topic. Roger, does it really make a sound, and have you ever been able to capture it?
Well, I can tell you something about that. First of all, of those people you mentioned, I've heard of them all. Shinaka Sofu, who is now over 80, he's still working here. So that was the person you were talking about. You were doing the plots of the aurora with, using all-sky cameras, I suspect. The question about the sound... We've tried very hard here to record sound from the aurora, and there's one area of the sound spectrum which we always get results whenever there's an overhead aurora, and that's infrasound. Now, infrasound is not audible. It's a much lower frequency than regular sound. That we can hear. The sound in the spectral range that you would hear with your ear, we have never been able to record. Now, that doesn't mean to say that some people don't hear it. You mentioned the hissing sound that you have heard. You're about in the 2% of the population that I estimate is capable of hearing auroral sound, given that it's the occurrence is likely. But most people can't hear it.
Any idea what could be causing it to make a sound?
Well, we are pretty sure it's not sound that they're primarily hearing, although the sound is the effect that they discern. The reason for that is that it is arriving, for most people report it arriving at the same time as they see the light coming, and there's no delay. There's a very big difference between the speed of sound and the speed of light. So it seems very unlikely that what they are actually hearing is sound that's traveled all the way from the aurora. However, it is possible that radio emissions that come from the aurora can make sound in the vicinity of an observer, and for them to perceive that. Mm. And that's what we think the mechanism is.
Todd, have you ever heard the sound?
I'm in the 98th percentile, and I've never heard them. I figured I didn't have enough magnetic filings in my head to pick up that radio frequency or something, but I wish I could hear them, but that's never happened for me.
Sometimes it's so dramatic, it seems like you should be able to hear it, right? I mean, it's for something that big and fast-moving to be silent is strange.
Yeah, I think, you know, there has been thrown out there that it's sort of psychosomatic where you see it and it looks like it's making noise, so you can kind of add noise in your own mind to it. But I've had so many people tell me they've heard it, and it's always the same description with that hissing, staticky noise that they're definitely picking up on something. Maybe that what Roger was talking about, those low frequency wavelengths.
Well, it's a great topic. We have a lot more to talk about, but right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Well, it's a big weekend. Iditarod is starting the tour of Anchorage, and here's some more events that you should be aware of. The 38th annual Banff Mountain Film Festival returns to UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium tomorrow, Friday, March 1st, Saturday, March 2nd. See short films on mountain themes, ranging from mountaineering to ice and rock climbing to wildlife and environmental issues, as well as mountain sports such as skiing, kayaking, and snowboarding. Tickets at uaatix.com. The Poems in Place Project aims to install poems celebrating Alaska's natural environment on permanent signs in state parks throughout Alaska. March 15th is the deadline to submit or nominate poems celebrating Totem Bight State Park, State Historical Park in Ketchikan and Chena River State Recreational Park north of Fairbanks. For more details on the project and submission guidelines, go to alaskacenterforthebook.org. On Saturday, March 2, the Eagle River Nature Center will host a family evening owl walk. Listen for owls and learn about their nesting habits on the Albert Loop Trail. Space is limited, but family events are ongoing at the Eagle River Nature Center. For more info, go to ernc.org. And you can find all today's calendar links at alaskapublic.org. Just click on Outdoor Explorer. In the second half, we'll be talking about Todd Sillette's exhibition, which is starting tomorrow, and many other things. But finally, for now, the Homer Winter King Salmon Tournament is coming up on March 23rd. It's time to get ready for that. And on the phone with us right now from Homer to tell us a little bit more about the 20th annual tournament, we have the executive director of the Homer Chamber of Commerce, Monty Davis. Monty, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Charles. Thanks for having me.
So, people do not think about king salmon fishing in the wintertime, but you guys have been doing it for quite a while. And I know this tournament is huge. I've seen the fleet of boats going out. What is winter king salmon fishing all about?
Well, these are all feeder kings that are here in Kachemak Bay and in the surrounding waters because of the incredible amount of food that they find here on a regular basis. So, yeah, we fish for kings all winter long. It kind of goes a lot like it does in the summer. Sometimes you'll talk to three or four people and they were out and they just absolutely killed them, and then, you know, it'll be two or three days and then they'll find them again because these schools of fish absolutely, you know, follow the bait, and sometimes you have to locate them, but boy, once they do, the action can be hot and heavy. I always like to tell people, you don't have to wait till spring.
That's right. For those of you who have your fishing Jones, just has to be taken care of. It's time to get down there to Homer. But most of the folks are going to go out with charters, because this is something where you really need some knowledge of what the heck you're doing.
Yeah, it does help, but you know, truth of the matter is, we do get a lot of folks who come down from Anchorage with their boats, and there's not big secret spots. Truth is, you know, especially when you have 800-900 anglers going out, anybody who has a boat who's, you know, really knows what they're doing. I mean, I wouldn't advise anybody who's absolutely a rookie on the water, but if you know what you're doing, you can certainly follow some folks and set up and troll just like they do, and chances are you're going to have good luck.
Excellent. So what is the prize and the entry details and all that stuff?
Well, we give away... The prize is based on how many people actually enter. The winning boat last year took home a little over $21,000.
Wow.
Yeah. And the neat thing about that is that during the day on the radio, everybody who has entered, their names all go into a drawing, and about every 15 minutes or so, we give away prizes that are sponsored by a number of different companies. Last year, we gave away almost $16,000 worth of prizes during the course of the day, never having caught a fish. I mean, that was to people who we drew their names and said, hey, such and such on the Skookum Charters, you know, you just won a fill in the blank, ugly stick rod, or, you know, I mean, we have a lot of great, obviously mostly fishing prizes.
Mm-hmm. So this is coming up on the 23rd. That's still a few weeks away. Still time available for people to make their reservations?
Absolutely. They can go to our website. We have online registration this year for the first time. Homer's coming kicking and screaming into the 21st century. But if they will go to homeralaska.org, on the home page, on the right-hand side under announcements, it says the Homer Winter King Salmon Tournament, register here, and they can go right to the registration page and get signed up. If they're not on a boat, we need to have people actually call us. We keep a waiting list here at the chamber, and they can call us at 907-235-7740. And as we get more and more boats registered, sometimes they will have an extra two seats, three seats. We try to put as many people on as many boats as we can. We just try to be of service.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Monty Davis of the Homer Chamber of Commerce, talking about the Homer Winter King Salmon Tournament. And as I said earlier, you can find all those links at alaskapublic.org. Just click on Outdoor Explorer. And so we're going to be back talking a little bit more about the Aurora in just a moment. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. Stay with us for the second half of the show on Aurora Viewing when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. If you're listening in the evening, it is a recorded rebroadcast and will not be taking phone calls. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime, download podcasts, and see what's coming up on future programs at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about the Aurora. We've got a good discussion going on, opportunities for you to get on the air with us, some really neat material about Facebook. I'm going to talk about all of that in just a minute, but right now I want to invite another guest to the air to talk for a couple of minutes about a totally different aspect of this topic. He's on the phone from us from Fairbanks. Robert Charlie is an Athabascan elder, originally from Minto, now lives in Fairbanks. And he agreed to come on and talk to us a little bit about the Alaska Native perspective on the Aurora and coming from Athabascan tradition. Robert, thanks a lot for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I was just going to say, I mean, the Aurora is so bright in your part of the state that there had to be some stories and legends associated with it. What sort of stories did people share in the old days about the Aurora?
Well, just the sight of the Aurora, and when we were young guys, we'd play around outside during Aurora, and we would whistle, and it would dance all around. And that was one of the things that I learned when I was a kid. And then...
So you knew how to control it, huh? You knew how to make the Aurora respond to your whistling?
Exactly, yes. But we can't all whistle at one time. We just listen to one.
Yeah.
So, and it also is a guiding light for us trappers that are out way in the dark, to have some light going home, and that served that purpose also.
Yeah.
And I want to tell you a short story about a traditional chief that we had in the interior. His name was Chief Andrew Isaac, and he's from Dot Lake and Tanacross, and he was our chief for about 20 years in the interior. He was our overall chief of the interior.
Mm-hmm.
And when he passed on, he was a very religious person. He talked about two things. He talked about education and religion. Those are the things that he talked about all the time. And he was, when he passed on, the night he passed on, they said there was northern lights from Alaska all the way down to Mexico.
Wow.
And that is true. And that was a good, that was a good indication that he knew what he was talking about when he was talking to us all along.
Yeah. So do you feel like there's a spiritual element there of the Northern Lights?
It's a spiritual element, yes. Mm-hmm. That's to show that he is where we all want to go. That's heaven.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I feel the same way when I see it. You know, you just feel like this is much bigger than all of us. This is some kind of a thing from another world that's contacting you.
Yeah. It's been our guiding light, you know, for that purpose, spiritual.
Was there any beliefs about it in from the old, you know, from the pre-contact days, from the old days, about what the aurora might mean in terms of legend or in terms of what the beliefs were back then? Or has it always been a little bit more like you're saying now, it's just when it happens, you respond to it?
That's all. You just respond to it when it happens. We don't have any story about it because it's something that happened all the time during the winter.
Do you still see it much when you live in Fairbanks, or do your lights kind
of
blot it out?
Oh, yeah, we see it every night almost, since we have clear skies.
I got to tell you, I was visiting from friends in Fairbanks, and I was having dinner with them, and then I went out to get in my car, and there was the aurora above me. And I said, wow, aurora. I ran back and knocked on the door and said, come on out and look at the aurora. And they came out and looked up, and it was a few green streaks in the sky, and they laughed right in my face. They said, we don't bother going outside for an aurora like that.
Well, we get a lot of visitors from Japanese because they believe in coming over to see the Northern Lights. Then if they're going to get married, they'll have a happy life.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've read there was an article in the paper recently talking about all the people coming into Fairbanks because the aurora is expected to be really strong this year.
Yeah, this time of the year is when it really begins to happen.
Mm-hmm. And it's not too cold to go outside.
No.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Robert Charlie. He's an Athabascan elder from Minto originally. He's calling from Fairbanks. We really appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you. I will hang up.
Okay. Bye-bye. My name is Charles Woolforth. The show is Outdoor Explorer. Our topic today is the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. Dr. Roger Smith, professor emeritus of the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks, is with us on the line. And Todd Salat, the aurora hunter, a professional photographer, is here with me in the studio. That you can also get involved in the show online on Facebook. It's Outdoor Explorer. And the main photo there is from one of our listeners. It's an extraordinary picture. Rebecca got this picture from Hatcher Pass in 2011. It's gorgeous. And underneath that, there's some comments about other pictures you can find and where they are. So you might want to explore that on Facebook. And we've got also some terrific pictures by Todd on our website. Go to alaskapublic.org and then click on Outdoor Explorer, including a film he made, and we're going to talk about more about that in just a second. I want to make sure to give those phone numbers, though. If you have aurora stories or questions, the number is 550-8433, or outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. Todd, your film, Catching Aurora's Light Waves, this has been shown in festivals, and it's gotten a lot of attention, and I guess you're also doing an exhibition coming up tomorrow, Friday. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh. Thank you, Charles. As a photographer, self-employed, my wife and I make our living on this 100%. We appreciate the good exposure, which is a pun intended there. But tomorrow night, March 1st, we have a First Friday event at the Aurora Fine Art Gallery in downtown Anchorage. That's on the corner there of 5th and G. And it's going to be a good time. It'll be running from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. It's our third annual Fur Ronde First Friday event. And I have several of my new releases there. I have a float plane image that I took just this past October when Anchorage got a wonderful display on a clear, calm night. that we'll be showing off in a big canvas. And also we'll be airing this 10-minute short documentary called Catching Alaska's Light Waves that I made this past year while cruising up to the Brooks Range in my truck and camper and filming it and getting some wonderful aurora experiences. Mm-hmm. So that'll be showing, and Glacier Brew House will be providing beverages. So it looks to be a good time. So come on down.
So in your video, you've got some pretty cool moving pictures of the aurora. Any tricks to that, or like you said, with the camera, or just have to have a good camera and just point it up in the sky?
Getting the auroras in motion has been a new passion of mine probably about the last 5 years. So when I made the big jump from film to digital, I realized that if you took a million pictures in a row and then blend them together, you can create the auroras moving. So instead of just a static image, you now get a feeling for the way they dance and twist and turn. And with that, I've been going to town, and I just absolutely love it. So that's what is in this movie, along with a little reality TV, you know, watching camping and things like that, campfires.
And again, folks can find that on our website. It's on Vimeo. And now we've got a caller. Larry's calling from Anchorage. Larry?
Hi. I'd like to ask your guests if they know anything about it. You may have already discussed this. I just started listening to on the radio, but about 30 years ago, I was in Christchurch, New Zealand, and there's a exhibit there for the South Pole, because that's where the South Pole explorers depart from, and it was a aurora exhibit, the Aurora Australis, and there were some pictures taken with an all-sky camera that was hung above a plane or supported above a plane, because the center of the aurora down there is not over land. And they were proving that the Aurora Australis is the exact opposite of the Aurora Borealis, because it's apparently the positive charged particles going one direction in the magnetic field and the negative charged particles going the other direction. And I just wonder if they've heard of that before.
That's a good question for Roger.
Yes, I have. Actually, I've been to that place in Christchurch, and I've been to South Pole now 11 times. The person that made that experiment actually still works here at the Geophysical Institute. His name is Hans Nielsen. And what he did was to fly two planes, one in the southern hemisphere and one in the northern hemisphere, to look at auroras that were places that were called magnetically conjugate. That means magnetically equivalent. And he discovered that, indeed, there is a very strong similarity between what you see at the same instant in the south as what you see in the north. That was great news in those times, because we didn't understand that. Now we have a much better understanding of it. And the reason for it, actually, is because the source region that generates the electron stream the electron stream that comes from that source divides into two main streams along the way back into the Earth, and they have the same original pattern that the source gave to them. So you see one in the north and one in the south. We have worked a lot on that to understand, you know, although there is a great deal of similarity, there are some persistent differences. And that's how you when you understand the differences as well as the similarities, you begin to understand the phenomenon much better.
So they aren't actually the reverse of each other, is that right?
They're mirror images.
Okay,
almost exact mirror images. Yes.
True that
so
the
I
southern
have,
is.
I have a question that I've never had answered before, and that is, how did they get it to be nighttime in both places?
Well, of course, you have to go there around the equinox time when that's possible. If you're going to do experiments from aircraft, you'd need to do it like that. If you're doing experiments from satellites, you don't, because a satellite can look at the aurora in ultraviolet wavelengths, where you can see the aurora during the daytime as well as the night just equally well.
And we're coming right up to March 21st, when it'll be 12 hours of daylight and 12 hours of dark everywhere on the Earth, like
yes.
2 days a year.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What a cool show. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Larry. We're glad to have you with us. I just wanted to point out to people that If you looking at our Facebook page, you can also find some more information about the Geophysical Institute and some of the rocketry they do, which is extraordinary. And on our webpage, I know I've got you running all over the place, but we've also got some more links to the predictions that the Geophysical Institute makes and their traveler's guide, which helps you, you know, if you want to go out and find the aurora. And now I'd like to go to Sandy from Anchorage, who had a comment or a question. Sandy?
Well, hi. I'm just concluding that people named Roger have specialties in Northern Lights, because I just got back from Churchill, Canada, one of the premier viewing sites. It's the Northern Studies Center, and it was fabulous.
So what did you see?
Well, I saw the Northern Lights. They would come yelling, "Showtime, showtime," no matter what time it was, you know, 2 a.m. You go out in a, you know, below 35 degrees, way below 35 degrees, and look at the Northern Lights. And it was conducted by Roger Willishan, who was a known astronomer in Canada. In fact, there was just a story about him in the Canadian Geographic. And when you see those pictures, you think, Photoshop, but apparently not.
Yeah, neat. Well, sounds like a good trip. A lot of people are coming here to look at the aurora rather than going from here to Canada.
I know, with Newcastle.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's magical, and everybody should see the Northern Lights.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for calling, Sandy.
You bet. Bye-bye.
It's Outdoor Explorer, the number on KSKA Anchorage, talking about the aurora. Obviously, the number here is 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752, and Facebook Outdoor Explorer. Roger, what you're still studying the aurora, and you are doing rocketry. I know there was a launch this winter up into the aurora. One might think that at this point we would know everything we need to know about it, but there must be questions that you're still pursuing. What's the cutting edge of your research?
Well, not this. What I'm going to talk about is not my personal research, but the big issue at the moment is exactly what determines the start of an aurora. You know, if I was talking to anybody, they would say, "Oh, well, it's when it first looks bright," and we often use the term breakup as terminating the end of the beginning and of the aurora and the beginning of the exciting part. But actually, if you ask, say, a dozen people who do auroral science, when is that, they will estimate it, maybe a minute differently, looking at the same thing. And so what was clear is that we don't yet know what exactly starts an aurora. And that's where the focus is on research these days. It's been done with computers. It's been done with satellite data and with ground-based data. And we're trying to get the right answer.
So the rocket is going into the aurora to take some, what kind of measurements?
Well, the one that went up last was taking measurements of something that we know is associated with an aurora. The planet actually exports, or that is, it shoots out oxygen into the interplanetary medium during an aurora. We lose oxygen from our atmosphere. It's not a very large proportion of it, like, you know, it's a very small fraction of what's actually here, but it actually does shoot out that oxygen as part of the process of creating an aurora. And so this rocket was there in order to try to measure it. You need to be very high up, like about 1,000 kilometers, so around about 600 miles. And that's where the rocket was when it was making those measurements. That high over Alaska on its way north with the highest part of the flight actually going so far that it landed up out in the Arctic Ocean.
And it's fair to say that Geophysical Institute has really been a leader in this kind of research, going all the way back to the International Geophysical Year in the mid-1950s and still is.
That's true. I mean, the most famous auroral scientist is the person mentioned by one of your callers earlier, Shin Akasofu. He became director of this institute and then director of a new institute next door. And he is still recognized as one of the leading auroral experts, even though he's over 80. And he made the reputation for us in auroral observation and auroral analysis.
Todd, I wanted to ask you a question. You have shared with us this solar cycle graph, which shows how the amount of activity from the sun rises and falls on this 11-year cycle. And you've plotted on top of that these incredibly spectacular pictures you've taken as to when they took place during that cycle. And when I look at your graph, I frankly don't see all that much of a pattern. It looks to me like you've gotten some pretty amazing pictures when the cycle was low as well as when it was high. Am I reading that correctly, or do you feel like, yes, the high cycle is really important?
Well, actually, excuse me, thanks for noticing that, because that's one of the things I did want to mention was, although right now we're in the peak phase, you know, people ask me what week of what year of what month is the best and at what time. And it's, well, you know, it's a much more broader time frame for that. This is the peak phase. But even back in the low cycle, say a couple few years ago, I was seeing auroras, you know, often actually, especially up north under the Aurora Oval, kind of in the Fairbanks and North region. And my wife and I drove up to the Brooks Range, up to all the way to Prudhoe back in 2007 to make a movie. And we saw the auroras 11 out of 13 nights up there in the trough of the cycle. So there's always solar wind streaming by the earth and, you know, generating the auroras. Definitely, you know, during the peak phase, you can get the more, you know, crazy wild shows where you might get some reds and purples and the real exciting colors. But there's always auroras out there. So this isn't the only time, in case you can't make it in March of 2013. You know, there's next year and the year after, and that's a good part of the phase too.
So it's just the really big ones are the ones that reach down to lower latitudes or will overwhelm city lights. Because Anchorage, the sky is so bright, you have to have a super strong aurora to really see much of it at all.
That's true. And, you know, right now with the more sunspot activity, you're going to get those bigger coronal mass ejections. And those cause those big auroras, the ones that make it to Anchorage and beyond. I mean, back in March, took a shot called Blast Off and Turnagain Nights. The auroras came over Anchorage and were heading south. And I know that night they saw them in southern Canada and northern United States, you know, down in Minnesota and such. And this is in the peak phase. That's when you're going to get those, you know, once a decade, huge displays that you never quite know what's going to happen. You know, tomorrow there could just be a monster explosion on the sun. And if it's pointed at Earth, you know, in 2 days, 3 days time frame, I would definitely tell everybody to keep an eye on the sky.
So if I see, if I look at Roger's website and I see there's a good auroral display coming up and I want to pack my family in the car and go to the best spot, but I can't drive all the way to the Brooks Range because I have to be back to work, you know, by Monday. Where would you drive to? Would you go to, like, Talkeetna? Would you go to Fairbanks? What's your advice for like, or would you just go 10 miles out of town?
If you're here in the Anchorage area, you know, the quick and easy is just to buzz up to Flat Top and get up on the upper hillside, a little bit off to the side of the light pollution of the city, and look north. And there'll be a lot of people up there with you, so it's kind of a wild time up there sometimes. After that, if you got a little bit more time on your hand, definitely head north. You got Eagle River, and then, you know, Talkeetna is wonderful. If you can get up and toward the Alaska Range, if you got the time and a place to stay, you know, the further north you go, the more likely you are to see them.
All right. Franklin's calling from Wasilla. Franklin?
Yeah. Glad I caught your show. I've seen the aurora, you know, ever since I was a kid, and it's, you know, four decades on now. But I've always seen the visible light that our eyes are accustomed to. When you're measuring the aurora in other wavelengths that we can't see, the infrared, ultraviolet, you know, on up and down the scale, how far does that go that's part of the aurora before it peters out, I guess, where, you know.
In terms of the wavelengths.
I'm assuming X-rays are not probably part of it, but.
Okay, good question. For Roger, what is the spectrum that you're looking at or that the aurora produces?
Well, the aurora is available into the far ultraviolet. You can see that from a satellite, but with the far ultraviolet gets absorbed in the stratosphere, and maybe a little higher than that for some frequencies. So you're not going to be seeing it from the ground, even if you had a detector that would see at that wavelength. you need to be high up, such as a satellite altitude, or at least up to, say, 60 or 70 miles. Now, as far as infrared is concerned, there are many infrared wavelengths that actually reach the ground level and can be seen with the appropriate type of detector. If you have a spectrograph that goes out to a few microns wavelength, then you are quite likely to be able to get records, although you won't see them with your naked eye. Quite a lot of the infrared does reach the ground.
Okay, good. Thanks, Franklin.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So, Roger, is there a practical purpose for your research, and or is there, you know, the aurora? I remember years ago they were talking about maybe we can get energy from it. I mean, it's beautiful, it's extraordinary, it's interesting, but beyond that, it's not. There's not a sort of a use for it or anything like that. And your research is pure research. You're just trying to learn about it. Is that true?
That is true. We don't have funding to work on the aurora from, let's say, an agency that needs to make a product from it. There have been uses in the past. Actually, when I was a graduate student, I did work for an organization in Britain that was interested in using the aurora as a screen against which to see aircraft, because aircraft would appear as black dots going across the aurora. Hmm. And we also use what's called the air glow, which is a naturally occurring emission, a lot less bright than the aurora, for the same purpose. And so it had a purpose then, but actually we've got much better ways of seeing aircraft against the sky now. The other thing that is of interest is that the type of plasma physics, and I have to just call it that, and you have to explain it on this program, something called plasma physics, which is about how magnetic fields and electrons and protons interact. This is used in making nuclear power generators. And some of the things that we do in trying to do the plasma physics of the aurora has its usefulness to those who are doing plasma physics to make nuclear power generators.
Interesting. We've just got a little time left. Todd, do you want to one more time tell people about where they can see your work?
Tomorrow night, Friday, March 1st, we'll be down at Aurora Fine Art Gallery with a First Friday event. There's kind of an art walk all the way through around town. Everyone, all the galleries have an artist in residence, and I'm going to be the guy there at Aurora Fine Arts tomorrow night. So if you're cruising by doing the fur rendezvous thing, please stop on in.
All right. Well, and we've got more questions that have come in through Facebook. You know, tune into Facebook at Outdoor Explorer and take a look at those, and we'll see if we can get answers to them. It's been a fascinating show. I want to thank all of my guests, Todd Salat, who's in the studio. He is the Aurora Hunter, aurorahunter.com. Dr. Roger Smith from the UAF Geophysical Institute, a professor emeritus there. And Robert Charlie was with us earlier. He's an Athabascan elder from Minto. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, our topic will be amateur mushing. That is, not the pros, but the family mushers. We'll talk with families who mush for fun and for transportation. Do you have sled dogs at home? If so, we'll hope you'll join us next week at 2 o'clock on KSKA Anchorage. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Kristen Spack is our producer, our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Charles Wolforth. Happy trails.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.